For the next several weeks, we're going to be talking about joy. And this morning, let me just walk us into this a little bit. How many of you know, have ever seen the Olympics? Seen the Summer Olympics or Winter Olympics? You know what happens at the very beginning? They've got the big ceremony, and what's the pinnacle of that ceremony? They light the torch, the Olympic torch. Well, last year in the Olympics, everyone figured that, you know, it was in Brazil, so they figured Pelé would be the guy who would go back to the picture of Pelé. How many of you know who Pelé is? All right, come on. Pelé was probably the most famous soccer player when I was a little kid, and everyone figured he would be the one to light the torch for Brazil in the Olympics last year, but unfortunately, because of health, he wasn't able to do it. And so they picked, you know, the next most obvious choice, Vanderlei Cordeiro de Lima, right? How many of you know Vanderlei? Yeah, exactly. And that's what a lot of people in Brazil even said. Who is Vanderlei? He's a distance runner who would run marathons, and he ran in the 2004 Olympics in Athens. And he shocked everyone because he wasn't that great an Olympic runner as Olympic runners go. His best time was minutes slower than the time of the typical winners. And so no one even expected him to really place in those Olympics. And yet, with just 4 miles to go, he was in the lead. And he had a good margin, a good lead over the other runners. And everyone is shocked, and they're cheering and yelling, this guy is actually going to pull this off, until a man in a kilt, show this picture, runs out and grabs him and pushes him to the side of the road, knocking him off the marathon path. A man in a kilt runs out in Athens, Greece, and knocks him off the road, slows him down. He loses the lead, and he ends up coming in third place. But as he crossed that finish line, Vanderlei was leaping and jumping and smiling for joy. And put aside how difficult that is to do after running over 26 miles. But he just got robbed of the best moment of his life. And he is jumping for joy, and he's so happy as he crosses the finish line and gets his bronze medal. And this is what he said afterwards, and this is what won him the admiration of the world at the time. He said, my medal is bronze, but it means gold. And he won all kinds of awards for the way he carried himself through that moment, through that joy. How would you have responded? Yeah. That's what I thought. How quickly is your joy drained from you? What does it take to sap your joy? A drunken man in a kilt? Or far, far less? Do you have a joy that is unshakable? Do you possess a joy that is powerful and immovable? Do you have a joy that sustains your every breath? Do you have a joy that is foundational to your life? Or do you have joy that is circumstantial? Do you have a joy like the foundation, go to your house today or wherever you live, go to the very, very bottom of it and look at the concrete or the field stone wall. Do you have a joy that's like that, solid? Or do you have a joy that's like the shutters flapping in the wind? Is your joy foundational or is it circumstantial, coming and going? For these next several weeks, we're going to focus on the joy of the Lord. Nehemiah chapter 8, verse 10 says, don't be dejected and sad, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. Now, if you've been around here for any amount of time, you know me at all, you know that I do not believe in and I do not like to just take a Bible verse and yank it out and just say, oh, look, it says, don't weep and mourn, for the joy of the Lord is your strength, and then try and make it mean something to me. I like to look at, okay, what's the context? Because here's the deal. The Bible can never mean what it never meant. So if I want to know what it means, I need to figure out and find out what it meant. Because in Nehemiah, all the leaders of the people of God are telling all the Israelites, all the people of God, don't be dejected and sad. The joy of the Lord is your strength. So let me just quickly tell you what happened there. Israel had been captive in exile in Persia. They had been basically taken from their homes, dragged off, and they were living as captives. Their city, Jerusalem, had been destroyed. Everything ruined and destroyed. But then God gave Nehemiah favor with King Artaxerxes, the king of Persia, who let him go and rebuild Jerusalem. And so here they are. They have worked hard and they have rebuilt this city. And everyone is gathered now and they're in the city. And it is a great moment. But in the process of rebuilding, they found the books of the law. They found the covenant that their ancestors had made with God. And so they all stand there one day in the courts of this the city they built, in the courts of the temple, and the leaders begin to read out this covenant that their people had made with God. That these other, they hadn't heard this, some of them ever. And as they're reading, all the people are realizing how far they are from being and doing what God called them to be and do, from living up to this covenant that God made with them. They're realizing it, and they are crying. They're standing there all day. A lot of us can't stand through three songs. They're standing there all day long listening to this, and they are crying and weeping because they're realizing, oh my God, look how far we are. Look how far we are from being the people of God. And that's when the leaders say to them, do not be dejected and sad. The joy of the Lord is your strength. The strength to be what God has called us to be is found in the joy that he rescued us before we were that. He came and rescued us and saved us, not because we lived up to the covenant. He came and rescued us even when we were far away from being who he called us to be. That the joy of that should now be what we live on. Don't live on the guilt and the condemnation of how far you are. You cannot serve God living on that. Instead, the joy of the Lord is your strength, is our strength to be the people of God. That's what they're telling them. That is foundational joy because it can't change. You cannot change what God has done for you. You may do things, I may do things that you wish you could change. What God has done, you cannot change. The way God has loved you, you cannot change. It is immovable, and that's why it is a foundational joy. And in that way, what happened in Nehemiah becomes this foreshadowing of what Jesus did in the New Testament. What has become foundational joy now for the church and everyone who follows Jesus. Because what God did in rescuing them and bringing them back before they were worthy, Jesus has done now for all of us, coming and giving him his life so that you and I could be free and live in this joy and live out this life of joy, becoming who God created us to be. And so over the summer, we're going to explore this joy by walking through Paul's letter to the church in Philippi. It is a letter that is dripping with joy. And I want to encourage you as we go through, just read through the letter of Philippians every week. It's very short, just four chapters or so, and just read through it every week and let it become part of you. Let it sink into your heart. And what we're going to see over these weeks as we go through Philippians, we're going to pull out and learn seven things about this joy of the Lord. But today what I want to do is I want to tell you the story of how this church in Philippi, this church he writes this letter to, got started. I want us to see the birth of this church because it is marked by those same seven aspects of joy, those same seven things that we're going to learn about joy mark the birth of this church. It's found in Acts chapter 16. So it's way longer than we could put in the bulletin, and I didn't want to type up all those slides. So go to the app for our church or grab your Bible or on your phone, your app, and go to Acts chapter 16. Right now, grab that and go there. If you're in our app, you can take notes and follow along, and at the end, there's questions you can bring into your life group, and you can go through there with them. But Acts chapter 16, and we're going to walk through this today, and we're going to see these seven things that joy does in our lives. Many of you will recognize Acts chapter 16. It's the chapter where Paul and Silas end up right in the middle of this chapter, the pinnacle of this chapter. Paul and Silas end up in jail in the middle of the night, thrown into the dungeon with their feet locked up. And when they locked their feet up, they like had them sitting like that. So can you ever had a cramp? right? And then imagine having a cramp and you can't stretch and do anything about it. Well, when your feet are locked up like that for a night, you're going to cramp up. And so this is what they are. They are in these stocks. They are sitting there in this middle of this dark, dank dungeon of a prison, and they are singing songs, worshiping God. The joy of the Lord that was in Paul and Silas that we're going to look at today helped give birth to this church in Philippi. So Acts chapter 16, my hope is that this will really shape us today. So let's jump into the story. The first thing about joy, the joy of the Lord empowers partnership. So if you're filling it out in the app right there, partnership's your word. The joy of the Lord empowers partnership. Here we go, verse 1 of Acts chapter 16. Paul went first to Derbe, then to Lystra, where there was a young disciple named Timothy. His mother was a Jewish believer, but his father was Greek. Timothy was well thought of by the believers in Lystra and Iconium, and so Paul wanted him to join them on their journey, to partner with them. But in deference to the Jews in the area where they were going, he arranged for Timothy to be circumcised before they left, because everyone knew his father was Greek. Then they went from town to town, instructing the believers to follow the decisions that the apostles had made, which you can read about in the chapter before, and the elders from Jerusalem saying, look, the gospel is for all believers, for Jews and Gentiles. And the churches there were strengthened in their faith and grew larger every day. And look, if you've read much about Paul and you know Paul and Timothy, you know that these two become like father and son. Right? This is a partnership that goes through the rest of their lives. They become like father and son with each other. And right here is the beginning of that. And it's amazing, and I don't want us to skip over the uncomfortable part, which is this. Timothy let Paul have him circumcised. And get all your junior high jokes out of your head. But that is not a big deal for a young guy to let Paul do that. That is something pretty significant that he trusts Paul to do here, right at the beginning. And that says something about this partnership. See, Timothy didn't have to do this. He didn't have to follow the Jewish tradition. They did it because they didn't want there to be a stumbling block in the mission that they were about to go on. They wanted to go and spread God's joy. And to do that, what Paul's strategy was, wherever they went, they'd go into the town, they'd figure out where the Jewish synagogue was, and they would go there and meet there and talk to them, because they were already people who believed in God. Now they just needed to know that Jesus was the Messiah. Jesus was God. And so he would always start in the synagogue talking to the Jewish men. And they knew, that if Timothy wasn't circumcised, that would right away become an issue for those Jewish men, and they would make a big deal out of that, and it would just get in the way. And so even though Timothy didn't have to do it, he trusted Paul's advice, and he put the mission of sharing the joy of the Lord in front of everything else, so that they could walk into those synagogues, and Paul could say things like, hey, everyone, remember in Nehemiah when God saved them and they lived on the joy of the Lord? Well, guess what? Jesus has done that for us in a much bigger way now, so that there wouldn't be any obstacles. They didn't want anything to get in the way. And a partnership where everyone is willing to do whatever it takes, even at great cost to themselves, even though it might be uncomfortable, because you're just sharing in common the joy of the Lord, that is a partnership like nothing else you'll ever find. We're going to talk about that more in the next few weeks, but look, you're going to have a lot of partnerships in your life, and some are going to be good and wonderful, and some are going to be bad and tough. But the best partnerships you will ever have will be built around the shared joy of the Lord, because that is what will unite you and stands above and beyond everything else. Every other thing you might have in common is going to fade. Senses of humor, teams you like, foods you like, clothes you like, music you like, hobbies you like, all that stuff comes and goes and ebbs and flows. The joy of the Lord, if you have a partnership that is rooted in that, that partnership is not like anything else. And look, hopefully here in the church is where you're going to find those kind of partnerships. But even here sometimes, it's been known to happen that even Christians sometimes lose focus on the joy of the Lord. It even happened with Paul. Just go a chapter before this and you'll see that a guy who had been a partner with him, John Mark, had let him down, had kind of lost focus on the joy of the Lord and let him down a little bit for a while. And then Paul comes out of that and God gives him this partnership with Timothy and with Silas and the others who go with him. And it's rooted in the joy of the Lord, and they'll do anything because they're serving the joy of the Lord together. You don't get that kind of partnership, this kind of partnership, by going around and trying to see, okay, who's going to be like me? Who could I partner with? That's not how you do this. What you do is you start living on the joy of the Lord. You start living in the joy of the Lord. You start taking joy in the things that God takes joy in, seeing people's lives transformed. You start living in the joy of the Lord and then look around you and see who else is living in the joy of the Lord. And now you know who might be a good candidate to be a close partner for you. Those of you who are single and dating, or looking to be married, or looking for someone to marry, you know, there's all kinds of people you can form relationships with. And a lot of times we spend all kinds of energy trying to figure out who's going to be our best match. We've even got it down to a science. We head online and we punch in all the information and we find the person who's going to match us, and that's wonderful and good sometimes. But if you go out desperately searching for a person, you're not going to find what God has for you in a partnership. It's not as likely. Better to do is you focus on living in the joy of the Lord. And then as you bump into people, you'll come say, oh, this person's living for the joy of the Lord too. And this person. And then you'll start to see, oh, we've got that main thing in common. Now we've got something that a partnership can be built on. And if you don't have that joy in the Lord thing together, your partnership will never be what it could be. I thank God so much for my partnership with Christina, and that all these years we've, right from the beginning, been able to just serve God together, whether it was volunteering in church as teenagers or through grad school and all the different things that we've done. And even now, getting to pastor a church together, always been this partnership God's given us. That's what you want, those of you who are looking for a partner. And the same thing is true for friendships. Sharing the joy of the Lord empowers partnership. That's number one. Two, the joy of the Lord also enables perseverance. So Acts 16, starting in verse 6, Paul and Silas, they travel through Phrygia and Galatia because the Holy Spirit prevents them from going up into Asia. Then coming to the borders of Mysia, they headed north to the province of Bithynia. But again, the Spirit of Jesus did not allow them to go there. So instead, they went on through Mysia to the seaport. How many of you are following this? Basically, it's like bumper pool. They're trying to go here, and God's saying, nope. And they're trying, nope. And they're getting bounced around, and they're just going. And everywhere they go, everywhere they get to stop, and they share the gospel because they just want to see people saved. To the point where verse 9, Paul is sleeping, and it's a night, and he has this vision of a man from across the sea in Macedonia who's saying, come help us. And so he wakes up and says, oh, God must be calling us to go over there. Let's get on a boat and let's travel across the sea and go talk to these people in Macedonia, which is how they're going to end up in Philippi. God has them bouncing all over the place. And it's like he funnels them. If you look at a map, you can see he's funneling them as they bounce back and forth down to a point where they get to Troas, and then they get this vision, and it's like, okay, we're at the seaport, let's go. And they get across the sea to go help these people. How many of you heard of the movie Hacksaw Ridge? Came out last year. It's a movie based on a true story of Private Desmond Doss. He won the Congressional Medal of Honor for his heroic behavior in World War II. He enlisted in the Army to be a medic, but refused to ever carry or fire a rifle because he had made a commitment to God that he would never kill anybody. And so he refused to ever shoot a gun or do anything to harm. He insisted he was only going to help and save people. And the Army hated him. They didn't want anything to do with him. His fellow soldiers thought he was annoying. They questioned his manhood. They threw shoes at him when he prayed. His commanding officer kept trying to get rid of him and transfer him. And then came this moment in Okinawa in 1945 where his unit had to climb this jagged cliffside place and try and take this ridge called Hacksaw Ridge. And it was heavily armed at the top. The plateau was heavily armed with Japanese soldiers. So not only was it treacherous to climb, now it was deadly because you had people shooting at you the whole time you were trying to climb it. And what Doss did that whole day, 12 hours, never picked up a gun, but he ran back and forth in that battlefield with bullets whizzing and flying by him, grabbing everybody he could who had been wounded, dragging them to the ridge, tying a rope around them and letting them down. Well, bullets are flying around him. Going back and getting another guy, dragging him to the ridge, tying a rope, letting him down all day, 12 hours straight. He ran through that field of battle. through that treacherous terrain with bullets whizzing around him, saving everyone he could get his hands on, wishing he could just get one more, just get one more, just get one more. And the movie ends with him rescuing his captain, which becomes ironic. But he says the whole time, Das says, the whole time I was running around grabbing everybody, I kept praying, Lord, please just let me get one more. And another guy who was there said, it's like God had his hand on Das the whole day. It's like God had his hand on his shoulder. I can't explain, I can't figure out how he possibly survived running back and forth the way he did. God must have had his hand on him. And in the end, he saved 75 men, including his captain, who had been trying to get rid of him. And that captain, at the end of the day, praised him, said he's one of the bravest persons alive in the documentary they filmed. And then to have him, the captain says, end up saving my life is an irony that it just changed me forever. Just wanted to save one more, just save one more. And I picture Paul and Timothy and Silas, and they're just going all over wherever God leads them and allows them just to save one more. They will persevere anything and everything just to save one more because of the joy of the Lord that's inside of them. And then I think of all the times I make excuses like, oh, you know, I see my neighbor and I know he's going through a tough time, but man, I'm late. I got to get going. I got this to do. I got that to do. All those times I don't persevere. All those times because I'm not living in the joy of the Lord, that I let those moments go by for fear of, oh, it's going to cost me something. I want to be like Private Doss running around this world, rescuing anyone, just one more. Just let me get one more person and just share the love of the gospel with them. And when you and I are full of the joy of the Lord, we can persevere through anything, especially for the cause of reaching someone for Jesus. That's number two. Number three, we're going to start moving quicker here. The joy of the Lord inspires hard work. So verse 11, they boarded the boat at Troas. They sailed straight through the island of Samothrace. And the next day they went to Neapolis. From there they reached Philippi, a major city in the district of Macedonia. Philippi is the city that we're focusing on today. And it's a Roman colony. So here's the deal. This is a city. They called it the Little Rome because it was just like Rome. The laws, the rules, everything was patterned to be just like Rome. And it was inhabited by former soldiers, former Roman soldiers. So this was a rough place, a strict place, an organized place that was tied to Rome, and they did everything the way Rome did it. They prided themselves on being Roman. Right? So that made things difficult for Paul and Silas and his group. Because when they got there weren't any Jewish synagogues. There weren't really hardly any Jewish men to reach. So their whole plan of let me go and try and, you know, work with those who already understand who God is out the window. They're starting from scratch. And it's not the way they normally do it. It's not comfortable. But they roll with it. They get right to work because the joy of the Lord, it inspires just hard work. So on the Sabbath, he says, verse 13, we went a little way outside the city to a riverbank where we figured there'd probably be a group of people praying because that's usually what they did. If they didn't have a synagogue, they'd go out and pray. And what they found a group of women there praying because usually that's what would happen. They didn't have a man organized. You have to have a certain number of men to organize a synagogue. They didn't. So they found these women out there praying. One of them was a woman named Lydia from Thyatira. She was a merchant of expensive purple cloth. And she worshiped God. And as she listened to us, the Lord opened her heart. And she accepted what Paul was saying. And she and her household were baptized. And she asked us to come in and be her guests. She said, look, if you agree I'm a true believer in the Lord, then you must come and stay at my home. And she urged them until they agreed. And they could have moved on to another town that would have been easier, where it could go the way they normally would have it go, because the road would have been smoother. But they didn't. And they didn't complain. They weren't looking to try and find the best place to stay. They weren't trying to find the easiest road. They didn't complain about the fact that the first group of people they were going to have inroads for the gospel were going to be women. And that was difficult in those days because women weren't as respected. They didn't complain about that. They said, okay, this is who's here. This is who we're going to talk to. And look what God does. The very first group they meet, they meet a woman who happens to be a merchant in town. She happens to be a business leader in that town. She's selling very expensive cloth, and she has a household, and she invites them to come and stay with her, which means she has a big house. She's wealthy. And notice how it words it in verse 14. God moves in her heart so that she understands and believes what Paul is telling them about the gospel and about the joy of the Lord. God opens her heart, and then she brings him into her home. And you know what that does for them? It gives them like a home base. It gives them a legitimacy in that town, because now they're not just wandering around sleeping out by the beach. They're staying in the home of someone who's respected in the marketplace of Philippi. And God takes care of them in there. See, sharing the gospel will be hard sometimes and difficult sometimes, but we do it. We do that work because of the joy God has put in our hearts. And along the way, as we do it, we get the joy, the greatest joy, seeing someone else get the joy of the Lord. And then God provides. God takes care of them. And Lydia becomes one of the first of three people that we see in Philippi who give their hearts to Jesus in this chapter. The second one, let me introduce you to her. Verse 16. And this will show us that the joy of the Lord focuses your priorities. Verse 16. One day we're going down to the place of prayer, and we met a slave girl who had a spirit that enabled her to tell the future. She earned a lot of money for her masters by telling fortunes. And she followed Paul and the rest of us, shouting, "These men are servants of the Most High God, and they've come to tell you how to be saved." And this went on day after day after day until Paul got so disturbed in his heart that he turned and said to the demon within her, "I command you in the name of Jesus Christ, come out of her." And instantly it left her. So let me explain to you what's going on here, because you may be wondering why Paul would be bothered by this girl following them and saying, "They're servants of the Most High, and they're telling you the way to be saved." Well, here's why this was so irksome to him. First of all, she has this ability to tell the future. The Greek word uses it as a pythonic spirit, because it's connected to the oracles at Delphi. Some of you may have heard of the oracles at Delphi from Greek history. People would go to them and to figure out everything from, you know, marriage to war. And so they go there and they would ask questions and be told, "Here's what will happen in your future." And so she was connected loosely to that, and she had masters. She was a slave. And they sold her to tell people's futures using this evil spirit that was inside of her. And so when she's walking around saying the Most High God, what she likely means is Zeus, not God of the Old Testament. That's one thing, or a couple things right there to keep in mind. Two, she's possessed by an evil spirit, so she's not speaking for God. And anybody with an evil spirit is not trying to promote God. What she's doing is trying to co-opt their message and connect it to herself, so that everything Paul and Silas and them, everything they preach, now ends up being connected to this evil spirit that everyone, "Oh yeah, okay, this is like the oracles of Delphi, and these guys are like servants of the oracles of Delphi." See, what she's doing is she's making a connection to idols and to evil. That's why Paul is so disturbed. Throw in the fact that this young girl has been enslaved by men who are manipulating her. And Paul is irked to his heart. He is disturbed to his heart, is what the word there says in Greek. And then you say, okay, well, fine. If he's so disturbed in his heart, why does he wait 2 or 3 days or 4 days, several days to just do something about this? And here's why. Because he knows as soon as he does, as soon as he says something, as soon as he sets her free, it's going to cause a storm. And it's going to bring all kinds of attention, and it's going to cause all kinds of trouble for him and those who are with him. And yet, he's so moved in his heart that he cannot not set her free. And the storm he knew would happen happens. Verse 19, her master's hopes of wealth were now shattered once she was set free. And so what do? They grab Paul and they grab Silas. You know why they grab Paul and Silas, but not Timothy and not Luke, who's traveling with them? Because Paul and Silas are and look Jewish. The other two didn't. They weren't. Timothy was only half Jewish. So there's a whole bunch of stuff going on here, not the least of which is racism. And so they grab them and they pull them in and they beat them. And they don't just like, you know, punch them in the face. They take wooden rods that, you know, like that, and they beat them with wooden rods. My mom spanked me with a wooden spoon when I was a kid. That's just a little spoon. And my butt was tougher than the wooden spoon. It broke, the spoon. They beat these guys with rods. Paul knew this was going to happen, but he did it anyway. He set her free anyway. They beat them severely. They throw them in prison, and they order the jailer, make sure they don't escape. Like, these are, like, super dangerous guys because they're messing with our Roman identity. And who are they, these filthy Jews, you know, here talking? They're trying to pervert our society. This is the mentality that gets these two thrown in prison. Paul knew it was going to happen, but he went ahead and set her free anyway. So the jailer locks them into the middle, the center prison, the center cell of the dungeon, locks their feet up in the stocks, and there they are in this filthy, stinky, dank, dark place. Their legs chained, they're chained up, they're in these stocks, uncomfortable. Because the joy of the Lord sets you free from worrying about yourself, and it focuses your priorities. And Paul just looked at the situation and said, you know what? I need to protect God's work, but I also need to do God's work. And if this is the way, God, you're going to do it, if you're going to do it through us setting her free and then suffering the consequences, so be it. I'm not going to worry about me. The joy of the Lord sets you and I free from worrying about me. And so you might be thinking right now, well, the joy of the Lord doesn't sound like too much fun, at least not for Paul and Silas. But here's the thing. The truth about this life is that it is full of trouble, and it will be full of trouble. It will be full of difficult times. You will go through horrible things sometimes that you cannot avoid. But the truth about the joy of the Lord is that it brings you a peace that is deeper than any trouble can ever cut you. And that's the next point. The joy of the Lord provides peace. So here's what happens. Around midnight, verse 25, Paul and Silas are praying and singing hymns to God, and the other prisoners are all listening to them. It's midnight. They've been beaten, thrown in jail illegally. By the way, we'll see that in a minute. And they are singing. They're not like, call my attorney. They are singing songs. Man, God, let me be like that. Then verse 26, suddenly there's a massive earthquake and the whole prison shakes to its foundations. And all the doors immediately fly open and the chains of every prisoner fell off. The jailer wakes up, sees all the doors open. He assumes the prisoners all escaped. So he pulls out his sword to do the honorable thing and kill himself. But Paul shouts, stop! Don't kill yourself. We're all still here. And the jailer calls for lights and they run into the dungeon. And he falls down trembling in front of Paul and Silas because he can't believe this. And he brings them out and says, sirs, what must I do to be saved? And he's thinking on this, there's probably a few levels to his question, right? How much does he really understand about, you know, we say the word saved, and you and I, we've got a whole load of things that means to us because we've read the Bible, and we understand to be saved, to be set free from sin and washed clean and follow Jesus. This guy just knows that he locked these two guys up and they were singing songs and then an earthquake set them free, but they didn't go free. They've got a joy that is amazing, and he should have just killed himself. But he didn't have to, but he's still feeling the fear of trouble because any Roman soldier who lets a prisoner go gets killed. How can I be saved? You and I will meet people all day long, all lifelong, who have, you know, they want to be saved on this level because they're going through trouble in their life. The salvation we bring is this level. It is deep salvation. And yet it's also the answer for this level. And so what do I do? How do I get saved from this trouble I'm in? But also, you obviously have something much deeper. Their answer to the surface is also the answer to the depth of his problem. And they tell him, believe in the Lord Jesus, and you'll be saved, along with everyone in your household. He is not just the Lord Most High, like every other God. He is Jesus. Paul named him to set that woman free. He names him here. Believe in Jesus. And they share the word of the Lord with him and his whole household. And then verse 33, even at that hour of the night, middle of the night, he brings them to his house, he washes their wounds, takes care of them, and then everyone in his house, they baptize him right there and then. And he brings them in, and now they get to stay in his home instead of in that prison cell. He feeds them a meal where they don't have to fight the rats for it. And he and his entire household rejoiced because they all believed in God. They discovered the joy of the Lord. There are two kinds of peace that Paul and Silas experienced here because of the joy of the Lord in them. The first peace was what led them to sing in the middle of that dungeon. That is it's a foundational peace. It's not circumstantial. It doesn't matter what the circumstance was. They had the joy of the Lord. No matter what hits it, it doesn't waver or move. The second peace they had was different. See, do you think they're happy in that dungeon, locked up, beaten? No, they're not happy. The joy of the Lord is not a drug that makes you forget what's going on or that numbs the pain. But the Spirit of God reminds you that you have a joy that is deeper than the miserable situation because God has already secured our rescue. And so the second piece they get is for them an actual rescue. An earthquake rattles the prison to its foundations because the foundation of the joy of the Lord is deeper than the foundation of any prison. And mysteriously, it shakes loose all the doors and all the chains and sets everyone free. And mysteriously, none of the prisoners leave. They were so attracted to the joy of the Lord in Paul and Silas that they all stay there. That's crazy. But so great is the power of joy. That's what it does. And because of their joy, we meet the third person who became the follower of Jesus, the jailer, who feeds them and bathes them, and his whole household becomes saved and they rejoice. The joy of the Lord is powerful. It gives you a peace in any and every situation. Number six, we just got two more. The joy of the Lord, number six, makes you indomitable. SAT word, right? Those of you who are students, indomitable. You cannot be overcome. Verse 35, the next morning the city officials sent the police to the jailer and they said, let the men go. So the jailer tells Paul, the city officials said you can go. You and Silas are free to leave, so go in peace. And Paul says, wait a minute. They have publicly beaten us without a trial and put us in prison, even though we're Roman citizens. And now they want us to leave secretly? Certainly not. Let them come themselves and release us. And when the police reported this, the city officials were alarmed to learn that Paul and Silas were actually also Roman citizens. So they came to the jail and apologized to them, and they brought them out and begged them, please leave the city. Now, listen. They were illegally arrested and beaten because they're Roman citizens, and you could not, without trial, arrest or beat a Roman citizen. They assumed they were just Jews, and so they just treated them like dirt. They made a huge mistake. The leaders of this town could lose their jobs, even lose their lives, for doing something like this. How would you feel, how would you react if you were, forget illegally beaten and arrested, if you were legally beaten and arrested, how would you feel? You'd be ticked off. They were illegally beaten and arrested. And then when it becomes clear, what would you do if you had the power to ruin the very people who mistreated you so badly? What would you do? Forget the hypothetical. What have you done when people have done things to you? How have you responded to someone who has treated you unfairly, illegally? Paul and Silas, they get up. And they rise above their personal feelings here because this is what the joy of the Lord does in us. It enables us to rise above, to become indomitable. Nothing can overcome the joy of the Lord. So instead of acting out of spite, because if they were acting out of spite, they would have called for the jobs of the magistrates, right? They would have gotten that whole town messed up if they were doing it out of spite. But no, they rise above it because the joy of the Lord makes you indomitable. Because it also means they don't become a doormat. Okay, it's fine that you beat us up. No, 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 no. So look at what Paul did. He said, they beat us publicly. They put us in prison publicly. Let them come and publicly release us now and apologize. But he wasn't being spiteful. What he was doing was being smart and tactful. He was full of the joy of the Lord. So he was able to see beyond his petty spite that you and I get caught in. and think tactfully. You see, at that moment, the church in Philippi is this baby little church. And it's got this merchant woman named Lydia and, you know, some people from her household. And it's got this formerly demon-possessed slave girl and maybe some friends who she's been telling about Jesus. And now it's got this Roman jailer who just a few hours ago was suicidal and his family. It's just this small little church. But here's an opportunity to bring legitimacy and respect to this fledgling little church in front of the entire city. So the joy of the Lord lets you see above your petty spitefulness and want desire for vengeance and do everything for the sake of the gospel. And it makes you indomitable. They don't become doormats. They think tactfully. That's what joy does. You see, whether he had the upper hand or he was suffering a raw deal, Paul remained the same because of joy. In plenty and in want, joy guided. The joy of the Lord guided Paul's actions. And then look at the last verse of chapter 16, the end of the story about how the church started in Philippi, and the seventh thing we learn about joy. The joy of the Lord establishes unity. Verse 40, when Paul and Silas left the prison, they went back to Lydia's home, and there they met with the believers and encouraged them once more, and then they left town. And they get that little picture. The church gathers at Lydia's house, this baby church. And you can just see Lydia there with the other woman from her prayer group. And that girl who had been demon-possessed, now set free, now knows the real joy and power of God. And this jailer with his family, this group of people from all kinds of different backgrounds. And they become one. And that's what the joy of the Lord does. The joy of the Lord establishes a unity like no other. So those are the seven things that we're going to be looking at over the next several weeks. The joy of the Lord empowers partnership. It enables perseverance. It inspires hard work. It focuses our priorities. It provides peace. It makes you indomitable and establishes unity among us because joy is a powerful thing. Joy gave birth to a church there. Imagine what joy could do in our church. And the joy of the Lord is what's going to change our church and our community. It's going to change your community and bring people to Jesus. There's so much more, and I'm kind of proud of myself that I didn't let myself run off into too many bunny trails today with this. Each week we're going to unpack a little bit more about the joy of the Lord because you need the joy of the Lord. I need the joy of the Lord in my heart. You need in your heart a joy that runs deeper, a joy that's foundational and not circumstantial. I know we need it because Jesus needed it. Jesus lived on joy. The joy that enabled Jesus to endure what he endured is what you and I can have as well. It says in Hebrews chapter 12, since we're surrounded by a huge crowd of witnesses to the life of faith, let us strip off every weight that slows us down, especially the sin that trips us up, and let us run with endurance the race God has set before us. We do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus, the champion, who initiates and perfects our faith. Listen to this. Because of the joy awaiting him, the joy set before him, he endured the cross, disregarding its shame. And now he's seated in the place of honor beside God's throne. Think of all the hostility he endured from sinful people. Then you won't become weary and give up. After all, you've not yet given your lives in your struggle against sin. I know you need joy. I know I need joy. Because Jesus lived on joy. He lived on the joy of the Lord. And that's what we celebrate here this morning as our servers come to the front. Joy was Jesus' strength. And the joy of the Lord is our strength. And how you and I will live on this joy is simply this. What he says there in Hebrews, look to Jesus. Keep your eyes on Jesus. And that is the simplest advice. You've probably heard it 1,000 times. It's the simplest and best advice that we never follow. Where have your eyes been this week? Where have your eyes been this morning? Are you practiced at looking to Jesus? Every morning, looking to Jesus and soaking in that joy that will enable you to live this life of the joy of the Lord. That'll give you this peace and this strength and form partnerships in your life and make you indomitable, make you able to get out and work hard and share this joy of the Lord. Are you looking at Jesus and getting that every day? encouraging your friends around you to look to Jesus every day. It's such a simple solution. And my prayer this morning is that as we serve these elements and partake of these elements together,